Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and Chris Prytower.
Another good week for the stock market this week. We're in positive territory, a little bit of a mixture, as the Dow Jones Industrial Average had a negative for the week. Of course, this is Friday. Things can change as we're doing this broadcast. We also have some hope that we will finally get a Chinese trade deal. Will that be big enough to stimulate the economy and accelerate growth into the second half of the year? Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Joining me in Hour 1 will be Craig Johnson, and he's taking a look at these markets and his belief that, believe it or not, we're going to end up the market at the end of the year lower than where we are now. Craig's trading range is from 25 to 2900 with a year-end target at 2725. And he also says something isn't right here. You're going to want to listen to him and find out what that is. Also later on in the program, Dan Steffens from Energy Prospectus will be joining us. And we hit upon a theme: demand for energy is greater than supply. We are seeing big supply shortage cuts by Saudi Arabia that are above expectations. We've got problems in the Faithful Five countries. You're seeing problems in Venezuela. You're seeing it in Iraq. They're cutting production. You're also seeing it in Nigeria and Libya. All of that is adding up to what you're seeing at the pump. Higher oil prices, close to $65 a barrel, and maybe heading even higher. And Ryan Poplava will be here later on to talk about what moved the markets this week. All of that in Hour 1.
Coming up in Hour 2, the big picture. We just dodged a bullet, but for how long? There's a lot of bullishness out there now that the markets have come roaring back this year. Still, there are some new risks that are emerging. Jim Poplava and I will discuss those risks. All of that's coming up in Hour 2, the big picture.
Thanks, Chris. It was mainly a wait-and-see market as we approached the first quarter earnings season this week. Additionally, we had a psychological technical level to kind of overcome, and we saw that firsthand on Friday when we started to move higher above 2900 and then had an intraday reversal where we started flirting back down below that level. So something that we definitely need to see and overcome. Maybe we'll see that through the earnings season further next week. Once we clear that level on a closing basis, it would open up the possibility of retesting the all-time closing high last year, which is right around 2930. Now let's talk about some of the key stories this week, though I didn't see anything that changed the narrative of essentially an easy Fed, steady economics, and an upward trending U.S. stock market. Now the Federal Open Market Committee minutes came out this week that were showing us what went on behind the scenes in that March meeting. And that essentially confirmed the message from the meeting, which was uncertainty over global growth and uncertainty over international trade that warrants a patient stance. Now, the key reference came from a part of the minutes that said a majority of participants expected that the evolution of the economic outlook and risks to the outlook would likely warrant leaving the target rate unchanged for the remainder of the year. And that confirmed what we saw last month in the projections for rates this year. Interestingly, since then, we have seen the probability rise for a quarter point cut in rates in December this year. From the probability was around 16.8% a month ago. Now it's 59%. Last I checked on Friday. Now the market had a muted response to the minutes because obviously we weren't expecting anything really new. The March policy statement and the dot plot, those were all pretty market moving events. Now in economic reports this week, total CPI, that's the consumer price index, had a big jump as oil prices continue to rise. And that's been a positive for the economy there. Now, CPI went up 0.4% in March, including oil and including energy, including food prices. But when you take those out, we call it the core CPI, was only up 0.1%. And year over year, that core CPI fell to 2% versus 2.1% last month, which should keep the Fed again, patient. Now, the weekly initial claims report this week was a highlight as well. Last week's claims dropped to 196,000 over the last week. That's the lowest level since October 3rd of 1969. Again, showing us that the employment market right now is very strong. And that with Bank of America recently announced this week that they are increasing their minimum wage to $17 an hour starting next month, continues to kind of support that idea that the U.S. economy is strong and employment is full. Now, the one down day we got this week, that was Tuesday, that was like the first down day in almost 2 weeks this week and last week, was a result of the Trump administration proposing tariffs on $11 billion in goods from the EU due to subsidies for Airbus that the U.S. was trying to combat here. Now, the EU said they are ready to retaliate if this gets implemented. Additionally, Tuesday, the IMF cut its global growth outlook to 3.3% in 2019, down from 3.5%, highlighting a lot of risks that could actually fall down even more later on this year. That was the only down day that we've had, and that's been since the stronger economic results we got out of China last week really lifted the market, in addition to positive trade news that we got from the Financial Times that highlighted the U.S. and China was almost 90% ready and done with their trade agreement. So the next biggest catalyst in my mind is the earnings season right smack ahead of us. I think we've had about 26 companies report so far. Two airlines this week, American Airlines and Delta. America lowered its revenue growth forecast in 2019 to 1% from 2%, citing the government shutdown and the grounding of its 737 fleet, while Delta reported a more encouraging outlook, and they actually raised their guidance on revenue to a growth of between 5 and 7% from what they originally were projecting, growth of 4 to 6%. And they're also seeing double-digit earnings per share growth. Now, they said that they are not experiencing capacity constraints from the grounding of the 737 MAX, which has caused its peers to have to cut things like American Airlines. Now, the response to the good news was somewhat muted, given that the stock had risen previously over the past month around 15 or 16%, only went up 1.6% for the day. But it was, again, highlighting that it was best of breed. Now, Friday, we had JP Morgan and Wells Fargo reporting, starting off with the banks. Next, I think Monday, we'll get Goldman Sachs and a few others. But JP Morgan Chase beat earnings by 30 cents for a big surprise, and revenues rose 4.4% year over year. With encouraging comments from Jamie Dimon that the stocks lifted nicely Friday, helping the Dow Industrial Average. And we also had a great news from Disney, really talking about their streaming service coming out pretty soon. And we saw huge growth in Disney as well. So the Dow Jones Industrial Average had a great day on Friday. Now, Wells Fargo did not share in the good news that JP Morgan did. They did beat on earnings by about 10 cents, but revenues fell 1.5% year over year. And they cited actually that loans did grow $3.8 billion from the fourth quarter. So mostly good results, down on revenues, and the company was down on the day. With 26 companies reporting so far for the S&P 500 as of April 12th, blended first quarter earnings per share growth is expected to decline 4.7%. Now, energy is expected to do the worst. FactSet is projecting a decline of 23.6%, while the best sector, healthcare, is expected to grow earnings by 3.8%. Now, the headwinds mentioned thus far from the companies that have been reporting have been weakness over China, which is what we also got in the fourth quarter, trade concerns still there, government shutdown, which was in the first quarter, and weather issues. If you look at some of the commodity related or farming type companies, we've got flooding in, I think, 7 states. So those prospects are very interesting right now. Dollar strength was a hindrance to some of the multinationals, rising raw material costs and global growth deceleration. So far, the headwinds that have been mentioned. Now, if companies can post and be forgiven for their poor first quarter results based on some of those issues being transitory, and if they can guide higher for the second quarter or the second half, then I think investors might be encouraged to bid prices higher. But if not, investors should brace themselves for a possible earnings recession. Now, the last time that happened was back in 2016, and that didn't necessarily lead to falling stock prices. If you recall, stock prices bottomed in February of 2016. But I think if we just look at the airlines, I think what it shows is doing good homework can really benefit you if you invest in best of breed.
Our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense Insider. That features interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's what you missed.
These are two completely incompatible systems. What Trump is addressing, he wants to change China's behavior in world trade and play to the rules of World Trade Organization. And obviously, he cannot change the system. The Chinese will not bend to the U.S. request to change their system. So both parties will eventually present the deal, whatever details there are in, as a great success, of course, and the markets will probably rally short term or peak short term when it is announced. But I think in 2020, when the U.S. presidential election campaign is on its way, I think Trump will already begin to attack China again.
We know life never travels in a straight line. Plans change, and sometimes you find yourself heading in a new direction. Let Financial Sense Wealth Management help you prepare for the unexpected. Our financial advisors, acting as fiduciaries for our clients, can provide guidance and sound financial advice. Contact a Financial Sense advisor today and begin your path to retirement. Call Financial Sense Wealth Management at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA, SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
It's been another good week for the markets this week, and you could probably say it's been another good year for the markets, especially after what we went through in the fourth quarter. Is all this good news for the market and investors going to continue? Well, let's find out why and dive into it. Joining us on the program from Piper Jaffray is Bullseye Craig Johnson. Craig, let's begin with the market. Looks like things are still looking pretty good since the beginning of the year.
Yeah. Hey, Jim. Thanks for having me back on. And, you know, in the markets, it's had certainly a very good year. You look at the S&P 500, you're up 15 and change percent so far for this year, and everything seems to be fantastic. And people are seemingly Q4 weakness is kind of a memory for a lot of folks. But I got to tell you, Jim, it's been a challenge for a lot of investors. They didn't get necessarily out of the way fast enough in Q4. They did not get back in quick enough. And so, Jim, right now, the pain trade is up, meaning that a lot of investors are still playing catch up because they did not position themselves and size their positions correctly in the environment in Q4 and also here in Q1.
Craig, let me ask you this. I'd like to get your take. Things were going very well last year. I mean, if we started 2018, we just got a $1.5 trillion tax cut. Corporate tax rates were cut from 35 to 21. Economic growth picked up to 4% and 3%, some of the best economic growth. If you were to sit in January of last year and say, you know, by the end of the year, we're going to be negative and it could be double digits, nobody was seeing that coming. How do you explain what happened in the fourth quarter and then what happened so quickly in the first quarter? Was this simply due to the Fed? What, in your opinion, caused all that?
Yeah, I mean, if you go back and rewind and you replay 2018, early in 2018, a lot of stocks were anticipating a lot of this good news, Jim. You went through and you looked at Caterpillar and you looked at Boeing and you looked at even 3M back then. All these stocks were basically what I call in the technical world, they were going parabolic. They were going straight up. And that good news was getting very well baked into those stocks at that point in time. And then you had a little bit of a scare with growth. And all of a sudden, those stocks sold off pretty hard. And that's what you saw back in the February timeframe. Then you saw kind of a rebuilding or slow rebuilding of that confidence all the way till you got till September. Challenge when you got to September, though, Jim, is that everybody was looking for this market to break out and continue to move higher. Unfortunately, what people were missing is that the market was being pushed ahead by a relatively few number of stocks. Remember the old acronym FANG? I mean, it's all we heard about last year, and now you're not hearing a whole lot about it this year. But at that point in time, you had about eight stocks that were basically, quote unquote, the generals of the market out on the field, and rest of the market and the rest of the foot soldiers have already stepped back and started to correct. And you saw that with the Russell 2000. So we knew that it was only a matter of time before you were going to see some sort of larger sell-off. We certainly didn't anticipate as deep and painful of a sell-off that you were going to have in Q4. And then when we got into Q4 and we got into the end of last year and into this year, what really changed was really, I think, the Fed induced a bit of a Fed-induced concern, shall we call it. They were raising rates. They thought the economy was perhaps stronger than they thought. And they went perhaps one step, maybe two steps too far. And then all of a sudden, the Fed came out and said, hey, we're back to neutral. And at this point in time, they provided growth investors, in essence, a open-ended hall pass. And you saw the market really start to respond to that. But a lot of this, Jim, was perhaps the Fed being a little bit too quick to take up rates and kind of missed interpreted the overall growth environment that we're seeing here in the U.S., but certainly around the world too.
Let's contrast that to last fall when you, as you mentioned, it was the FANG stocks that everybody talked about. I can remember when we were talking about trillion-dollar market caps for Amazon and Apple. As I look at the sectors in the S&P, a lot of them are breaking out to new levels. You have technology, you have REITs, you have utilities. It's pretty hard to find a sector that is not doing as well, perhaps with the exception of energy, which is still a laggard.
Well, I mean, energy on an unweighted basis at this point in time, Jim. Let me just say this. Let me back up before I dive into energy. There are a lot of sectors that are certainly doing very well. When I go through our proprietary group work and our relative strength rankings and stuff we've got here at Piper Jaffray, Jim, what I am seeing is yes, strength definitely in technology. And I'm also seeing a lot of strength in energy, to your point. You also have seen this kind of interesting barbell scenario where a lot of people were looking for some sort of double dip in this market. That certainly didn't happen. But as we've seen this market progress and move forward, we've also not seen a scenario where the financials have participated. Jim, that's the one thing that I step back and I look at that really bothers me about this market, is that the financials are not participating. I've always been brought up to believe by all the, you know, great technicians, and many of them you had here on this show, and they all come back and they say, for this market to really work, you need financials to be engaged, and at minimum, engaged in participating. Doesn't have to be leading, but it has to be engaged. You don't have that. I go through and I look through a lot of these financial stocks right now, and they look terrible to me at this point in time, many of these big banks. Now, coming back to your question about energy, energy's been this kind of nice proverbial, call it a dead cat bounce coming off the lows you had seen back in December of last year. They look good, but you know, under fair disclosure, we've downgraded energy from an overweight to a neutral as I'm finding other things that look more interesting to me. I'm finding the services sector starting to pick up, and some of those financial service names looking pretty attractive. I'm also seeing things in consumer sector, cyclical specifically, that look constructive. And of course, technology. Some of the names like Cisco, charts look great. They look terrific. They've been breaking out the new highs. You're continuing to see a lot of interesting setups and charts in semiconductors and some of the software and services type names, still looking very constructive on the charts. But at the end of the day, for me, energy, I think this is a sector that has had a nice rebound. I think it's an okay sector, but I don't think that it's going to be true leadership. It's kind of the mid part of the distribution when I think about where the returns of the market are going to come from this year, Jim.
So when you're looking at the S&P, you take a look at consumer discretionary, that is breaking out. You take a look at, but also if you look at, Craig, how do you explain, you look at also, consumer staples, they are sort of looking like they're ready to break out. And then you also have real estate and utilities. Now, the real estate and utilities reminds me it's a play off lower interest rates. What's your take?
I agree with you 100% on that. It's about 10-year bond yields. And 10-year bond yields have just backed up. Looking at my screens right now, and we're sitting with 10-year bond yields here in the U.S. sub 250. That, to me, just it bothers me. Like, we have a tax cut that's been put in place. We've had all this stimulus put in place. And we're sitting with really not a lot of inflation. We're sitting with 2.5% on the 10-year bond yield. Outside the U.S., certainly a lot of challenges. But Jim, the spread from the 2 to 10 is sitting at 14 basis points. So despite the Fed coming back and giving us this open-ended hall pass, we haven't seen any sort of steepening in the curve. And some argue, hey, Johnson, don't worry about that. We're going to sit here with this kind of flat curve environment for a long time. And stocks are just going to continue to work because, well, Tina, there is no alternative. And at this point in time, you just got to buy equities. I just think that's a kind of a bad reason to step up and put capital to work and buy equities in here. I'm sitting, Jim, with a price objective for this market. I'm looking for a range. I've been talking about it since November, which is basically 2,500 on the lower end, 2,900 on the upper end for the S&P 500. We're essentially there now, and I'm looking for a year-end objective of 2,725. And yes, that is lower than where we are at this point in time. And there's a couple reasons for it, Jim. I want to see the 2 to 10 spread start to widen. I want to see participation in this market start to improve. I'm right now having flashbacks as I look at all the internal gauges that we've done here with all of our technical work. And Jim, guess what? They're barely even starting to move above 50% type readings. And let me explain that. I've got about only half of the market above its 40-week or 200-day moving average at this point in time, despite this market being only a few percentage points off of new highs. This is exactly what we saw back in September. It's what we kind of were seeing in that time frame, and the market needed to take a little bit of a breather and a little bit of a reset. In terms of new highs and new lows, not as strong as what I would expect. And Jim, when we come off of really oversold readings, like we had seen in December of last year, you typically go from less than 10% of all the stocks in the market above their 200-day or 40-week moving average to usually 70 or 80% readings. At this point in time, we're at 50. That worries me.
Yeah, and you mentioned a couple things here that really strike me. We saw that short-term inversion a little over a week ago. You've got the 10-year at 2.5 instead of at 3 or 3.25 where it was in the fall of last year. The financials aren't participating, and if the financials aren't participating, you know, that tells me there's something going on the credit side of the markets. What's your take there?
Jim, I think that's spot on correct. I'm not seeing exactly what it is at this point in time. And, you know, maybe for the financials, maybe for the credit side. But as I go back and I just look at all these banks, you're seeing major corporations, Apple and other places, go and start brand new business ventures, such as their television business and other things. They don't even need to come back to the banks. You're ending up with an economy that does not need as much capital to start new businesses, to grow and to do new things. Perhaps that's some of it too, why the financials aren't participating. Perhaps there's credit issues. You got major mergers happening potentially with Commerce Bank and Deutsche Bank over in Germany. There's just all sorts of different aspects of perhaps credit, perhaps financials that are just leading to this you know, this market not really moving up. And Jim, I'd also just add, when I look around the globe, you've now starting to see, you got Switzerland with negative rates, you've got Germany, the Bund moving back toward negative rates. So you've got an environment where, yeah, the U.S. still remains the cleanest shirt in a dirty shirt pile at this point. But from my perspective, that doesn't mean that all of a sudden equities are going to continue this run. Keep in mind, Jim, we are in the third year of a presidential term, or a cycle, I should say. And in the third year, markets are typically strong from January to about the 4th of July, give or take. And then you tend to be weak in the second half, July through the December timeframe. So I've been viewing this market as a market where I think a lot of the good news is getting priced in at this point in time. And in the second half of the year, maybe we're going to find that there's going to be some disappointment. Maybe the Brexit gets kicked the can down the road type scenario. Maybe a trade deal with China gets kind of pushed out further than people think. And because of that, maybe the multiple of this market doesn't continue to expand. Or Jim, perhaps we find as we get through Q2 earnings season here, that earnings are not going to be as strong as people had been anticipating. And as such, maybe a little bit of air comes out of the balloon at this point.
Yeah, because I'm looking at this, Craig, and I'm saying, you know, the stimulus will be spent by the time we get to September. The news about the tax cuts, companies are going to have tougher year-over-year comparisons. And the IMF just downgraded this week their global economic growth. So if you've got economies that are slowing down, somewhere that's got to be reflected in company sales or company profits. And as you just mentioned, I mean, what was it? The German Bund got down to like 1 or 2 basis points, and you've got all those negative yields in Europe. I mean, the Treasury at 2.5%, Craig, looks like a junk bond when you look at yields over on sovereigns in Europe. So I'm asking myself, maybe you're asking yourself the same question, what is going to be the catalyst that is really going to push this market? Because now I've seen strategists upgrade and saying this market is going to hit new records. I've seen 3,000 on the S&P. And, you know, of course, you're saying, hey, from where we are now, this is going to end up at 2725. So I'm looking, where's the catalyst? What is it that's going to push stocks higher?
Jim, the hope trade is what is people are basically placing their bets on, and they believe that with the Fed having an open-ended hall pass here, that they are going to do nothing to stop this market, and they are going to continue to perhaps even cut rates, and that's going to keep the growth trade going. You've got that factor. You also have the fact that people believe that there's going to be some great trade deal done with China. And at that point in time, this market's going to have a whole nother leg up. Well, I guess I look at this and I say, how much of that is already priced in? Because the market is a terrific discounting mechanism of future events. And so I just question how much of that is baked in. And as we progress further toward the 2020 elections, I suspect less and less is going to get done in Washington at that point in time. So we can point to a trade deal. We can point to a couple of these different other pieces. But I don't know about you, Jim, and the listeners here, but I'm kind of tired of talking about the trade deal. It either needs to get done or it doesn't need to get done. And they need to quit talking about it, because that's really not what's been driving stocks, in my view. It's been just the Fed, and basically the Fed coming back and providing us that liquidity.
Yeah, that's the only thing I have seen. The other thing that, you know, the market, the futures market is pricing in 1 to 2 rate cuts by the end of the year. The only way I could see the Fed doing that, Craig, is if, you know, we always know that second quarter tends to be the best quarter of the year, third quarter, another good quarter, and then it starts to slow down Q4 and Q1. The only way I could see them doing that is if we have another bad slowing quarter in Q2, you might hear them talking about cutting rates. But if the economy's growing at 2%, why are they going to cut interest rates?
I'm not sure there is a need or the evidence at this point in time to have to come back and cut interest rates at this point in time. I don't see it either. You know, you mentioned Q2 earnings season, and a good friend of ours came out and wrote a piece the other day and said, Q2 earnings season seems like there's a lot of negativity. Earnings have already come down. It's like falling out a basement window, right? Nobody gets hurt when you fall out a basement window. Expectations are low. Maybe we're going to get a little bit of an upside here. But to your point, Jim, if these numbers are not great here for Q2, and it certainly provides a little bit of stimulus, it's going to be a challenging setup for the second half of the year. And I would think volumes across the market are probably going to be fairly low, as investors don't see a need to have to do a lot, given the fact that some of them have already locked in some pretty good gains for the year.
You know, this almost reminds me that this could be almost a reversal of last year. Last year, we had a very strong first half of the year and leading into the fall, and then, of course, we went negative. This year, we're coming right out of the gate with that V-shaped recovery in the markets. Markets are having a good year. Could it be the good year is the first half, and in the second half, we start running into problems?
That's what history would normally say. History, third year of a presidential term typically plays out that way. You get all sorts of weakness, or you get a market that is not strong in the second half of the year. And it just ends up becoming, I don't know, kind of an okay year. It isn't a great year. But again, we've all done this long enough, Jim, where we can come back and look at this tape and look at and say, wow, we're up 15%. If we're looking at kind of normal returns, and what sort of returns do we need to have to meet retirement objectives and those kind of things for the listeners out there, well, 15% return is a great year, but it's not really what expectations are built upon for retirement purposes.
You know, I remember you telling me a story. I think it was 2007, and you were going around telling everybody, trouble's coming, and they were saying, Craig, you're crazy, the market's going up, the economy's doing well. Do you get any of that kind of pushback right now? Because, I mean, I'm hearing you be a little bit cautious here.
I get a little bit of that pushback right now, Jim. People are like, Craig, your price target is $27.25. The market is almost at $2,900. And I remind them, we've been looking for this kind of sideways consolidating market, which is going to take some time to digest these things. Psychological wise, yeah, I'm hearing from a lot of people that say, you know, you're wrong. This market's going to continue to work and continue to surprise. And maybe it's an environment like 1995. And as such, there's going to be another whole nother leg higher in here. My answer to that is I'll believe it when I see it in the numbers for all the work that we do. And I think one of the more valuable things that we've done over the years is we're not always perfectly in sync with consensus. And some points in time where we got to kind of stand up and say, hey, wait a sec, this market is not doing what it should be doing based upon history and based upon our experience having done this for years. And people get excited and caught up in the moment and feel like they're missing something, and they end up stepping into the market at kind of the wrong time. So we're pushing back a little bit, Jim.
So as we sum up here, Craig, you're a little bit on the cautious side. It's been a good year so far. Maybe not a bad idea to maybe take some chips off the table. I watch football, and sometimes, you know, you'll have a team that'll come right out of the gate in the first half of the year. They're up 20, 30 points, and what they do is they take their biggest, their best players off the field because they don't want to get them injured, and they ride out the game, but they win.
That's a logical strategy, you know, at this point in time. Again, there's got to be so many things that are going to have to come together for us to see this market take another meaningful move higher in here. And Jim, when you go back and you just look at like a histogram, we've done a histogram of all the returns on the S&P 500 going back to the early 1900s. And when you come back and you look at that histogram, you say, how many years do you get returns north of 25%? How many years do you get returns north of 30% or even 20%? And when you start going through and looking at that total return, and you start looking at those years and the environments that you were coming from, those were years that were pretty big rebound years. But at this point in time, we've already kind of recaptured a lot of the gains. And thinking about it from here, are we really going to get another 10 or 15% from here? And if the answer is kind of a more difficult probability to see that getting played out, then you have to be trimming some positions in here, taking some profits.
I couldn't agree more, Craig. Well, listen, Craig, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow the great work you guys do at Piper Jaffray, tell them how they could do so.
They are welcome to email me at craig.w.johnson@pjc.com, and happy to chat with them. And they can also reach out to their Piper Jaffray salesperson, too.
All right, Craig, thanks so much for coming on the program. Have yourself a great weekend.
Thanks, Jim.
Our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense Insider. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
This week we spoke with the ever-prescient and outside-the-box forecaster Martin Armstrong on FS Insider. Here's a part of what Martin had to say on why central banks have such a hard time, particularly the U.S. Central Bank, the Fed, on managing the economy through interest rates when the U.S. is the largest holder of U.S. treasuries.
Governments cannot manage the economy properly. All these economic theories are bogus. How can the Fed raise interest rates to reduce demand when the government is the biggest borrower? You then raise the interest cost to government, which blows out the entire budget process, which then makes them come back and say they want more taxes.
In the remainder of this interview with Martin Armstrong, he also explains why he believes that the U.S. stock market is going to continue to push higher while Europe experiences an ongoing political nightmare and hard landing. If you're not already a subscriber to FS Insider, simply go to financialsense.com and hit the subscribe button. And keep in mind, you can listen to FS Insider podcasts off our site or through your mobile device using a podcast app of your choice. If you have any questions about our service or how to gain access, feel free to go to financialsense.com and hit the contact us button. Again, if you want to become a subscriber and listen to the full range of interviews that we conduct with Martin Armstrong, Felix Zuloff, Jim Bianco, and others, just go to financialsense.com and hit subscribe.
Well, it wasn't too long ago that everybody was lowering their estimates for oil this year, especially after what happened in the fourth quarter. Investment banks lowered estimates to the low 60s. Well, we're in the mid-60s right now, and many are now upgrading those estimates, thinking we could head higher. Well, let's find out why. Joining me on the program is Dan Steffens from Energy Prospectus. And Dan, let's talk about a couple of things that changed. One of them changed immediately with the downdraft in oil in the fourth quarter. We saw OPEC quickly respond with production cuts. Those production cuts are starting to kick in. And also, there's been some revisions on some of the oil production coming out of the shale patch. I think the EIA was overly optimistic.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think the main reason it's going up is Saudi wants $80 Brent, and they definitely got the ability to get it if they want to. And the way they're cutting their production way more. I saw today the report came out from OPEC itself that Saudi Arabia is producing 500,000 barrels a day below the amount they agreed to in the December agreement with OPEC. So they're leading the way, leading the pack, and they want to ratchet up oil prices. And then you got the situation in Libya and Venezuela, and the economy is probably a lot better than people thought it would be. So gradually, one by one, all the fears that kept oil prices low are falling away. And people are starting to see that we got a much tighter global oil market than they thought.
You know, there's two things that I think the oil bears weren't looking at. Number one, the demand for oil, because we keep hearing about peak demand, has been much greater than expected. I don't care anywhere you look around the globe. If economies are expanding, they're using more oil. If a Chinese consumer buys a car, you just have another oil consumer. So that was one that was underestimated. But let's talk about something that's happening now that's impacting the oil, and it has even a bigger impact, and that is political disruption. I don't care if it's what's going on in Venezuela, what's going on in Libya, what could go on in a Middle Eastern country, but you know, that's probably one of the more difficult things to predict, Dan, is what can happen geopolitically in these oil-producing regions.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, they call them unplanned supply outages for a reason. And when you add it up and you take the situation in Venezuela, which is probably going to get a lot worse before it gets better, and it doesn't look like Maduro is going to step down. So if this turns into some kind of violent coup or something down there, that could get a lot worse. I mean, their production could actually go to zero. I don't know if you've seen, they had two major electricity power outages in the country that actually shut down their largest export port. And so their production, I think, is down 400,000 or 500,000 barrels a day from February to March. And then you got the situation in Libya, which came out of the blue. I mean, I did my newsletter about 10 days ago, and there was nothing out there on it. Now it's the hot topic. And so far, it has not affected Libyan production. But, you know, they export about 1 million barrels a day. So that could have a significant impact on the global market.
You know, as you talk about that and these disruptions, and sometimes they can be weather related. I think of what happened to oil production in the Gulf of Mexico in 2005 with the hurricanes. Mm-hmm. There was, of course, a couple of years ago, the fires in the Canadian oil sands. And then, of course, you know, we have these political disruptions. But I think overall, what the market is forgetting about is every single year, the demand for oil is going up. Yes, we have electric cars. Yes, we're seeing more of that. We have, clean energy, whether you want to call it sun or solar. But Dan, I don't see, despite the Green New Deal, I don't see fossil fuels being replaced by anything on the energy front for at least a couple decades.
Yeah, the thing people forget is that the energy market is just a massive thing. I mean, it doesn't turn on a dime. You're not going to throw out 100 Teslas and it's going to make a dent in the oil demand. I saw a report last week or when I was writing my newsletter that they said, okay, we sold 2 million electric cars last year, but there was over 90 million total cars and light trucks sold. So all the rest of them were internal combustion engines. So the pie just keeps getting bigger. Yes, we're going to sell more and more electric cars each year. More and more people will go over to that technology, and thank God we have it, or you'd already have, you know, gasoline in the United States, $5 a gallon across the board. But it doesn't happen overnight. And as you said, it's just the most consistent thing really on this planet almost is that demand for energy goes up every year and demand for oil goes up from 1 million to 2 million barrels a day per year. And this year we're going to top 101 million barrels a day of demand for refined products, most of which are made from crude oil, from black oil. So,
Dan, go ahead. What is it about the IEA that for what, the last 6 or 7 years, they've been underestimating the demand for oil? And of course, when they revise that estimate, it's sort of buried in the back pages. But they've done that for what, 5 or 6, 7 years in a row. And the other thing is the oil markets focus so intently on these weekly inventory numbers. And as you and I know, they're not an exact science. It's not like they have a dipstick that they put in the, you know, the engine and say, okay, that's how much oil that we have. Yet that's what moves the markets at times.
Oh yeah, those weekly reports are nothing but guesstimates. As you said, they do not have a gauge on every oil well in the world or even in the United States. It's the most accurate estimate that there is in the world, but you really don't even know when the state reports come out about 90 days after the end of the month. Even those get revised for several months. Kind of don't really ever have an accurate number, but it's not even close to accurate when they do these weekly reports. So they're just all based on formulas and their guesses and, you know, counting the number of ships that unloaded in the Gulf of Mexico or something. And one thing, people need to understand the seasonality of the oil market, especially in the United States, because our refining industry is very seasonal. And right now they are wrapping up their semi-annual maintenance period. So we have refinery utilization is running at about 85% of capacity, but that needs to ramp up to over 95% of capacity here within the next 3 or 4 weeks in order for us to meet demand for transportation fuels. The EIA report today on April 10th showed about a 7 or 8 million barrel drop in gasoline inventories because the refiners are not making enough gasoline to even meet current demand. So that's why you had oil go up on Wednesday instead of going down when they showed a big build in the crude oil inventory. And this is a time of the year when crude oil inventories need to build. They must build this time of the year so that the refineries in May and June have got the feedstock that they need to produce the fuels that we're going to use.
You know, Dan, something also that we have to think about, you know, yes, we're coming out with clean energy. We've got wind and solar, but those are two sources of power. They're intermittent. Some days it's not sunny, and some days the wind doesn't blow. So I don't see how that would really take over the power system. And as you mentioned, electric cars. But let's talk about the other forms of transportation, how we transport goods and people. And I'm talking about airplanes. I'm talking about ships that cross the ocean to bring us goods, and the trains that transport goods, and the trucks.
Oh, yeah. There's no way that this is all going to shift. Like the Green New Deal, when they say we're going to get off oil within 2 years or 12 years, if that's even possible. Well, 12 years may seem like, you know, a lifetime to a millennial, but to me, it doesn't seem very long. And I can tell you, there's nothing going to happen that fast. You don't transition anything this big that fast. So that's just not going to happen. And ships, trains, airplanes, you know, they're all going to need liquid fuels. There's no way you're going to have a bunch of solar panels on the wings of airplanes or something to make them go. But anyway, it's an interesting discussion, that's for sure.
You know, as we take a look at, we're consuming more oil today, we're producing more oil today, I want to talk about something that could be a negative for oil, and I want to move on to what's going on the trade front with China and the U.S. We've had some economists on here And they're saying that, you know, if there's one thing that can derail this global economy, maybe not put us in a major recession, but maybe a slight recession, and which would reduce demand, and that is the continuation of this trade conflict. So let's talk about that, number one. In number two, we know, I think it's the month of May, that the waivers on Iranian oil are supposed to end, and Trump is running for re-election. And he constantly tweets, and it seems like his tweets are being ignored by OPEC right now. But he wants to get reelected, and he knows to get reelected, he needs a strong economy, which brings into question, does he really want a trade war continuing into next year in a recession? And number two, he doesn't like high oil prices, but how do you avoid that when you are putting sanctions on Venezuela and Iran?
Yeah, I agree with that. I don't see how he is going to avoid it. And I think Trump knows that he has to come to some kind of resolution with China over this tariff war. This just can't go on. These are the two largest economies in the world, and they can't be, you know, fighting over this stuff forever. I've heard that they're very much in agreement on 99% of the terms, and all they're doing now is trying to get the English version of the agreement and the Chinese wording of the agreement to agree, so that they make sure that, you know, what the English people think is it, we're saying that the Chinese agree with that, that they understand all those terms. So if that's it, maybe we're talking about, you know, within a few weeks, this thing gets resolved. And if that gets resolved, I expect the oil price to jump up $3 to $5 a barrel just on that announcement, because one of the main things that's keeping the oil price down is this fear that this tariff war will go on and on and on and will derail the global economy. And that's the only, you know, legitimate fear that I see that's going to keep it down, because we're obviously heading toward a period where demand for oil-based products is going to exceed supply. I mean, everybody's reporting that, even your friends over at IEA that are usually very conservative in their projections are predicting that for like next month. Anyway, I don't see how he's going to get both. Now, I do think that if the situation with Iran, if Trump stays tough with them, I do think Saudi Arabia and the other Persian Gulf countries can ramp up production a little bit. I don't think they want to let the oil price get out of hand. I think they'll be very happy if Brent gets to $75, $80 a barrel, which would take WTI up to, you know, close to $70 a barrel. I think they'll be very happy with that price, and then they may start easing up on these production cuts to balance it. I don't think the last thing they want is to throw the global economy into a recession because they take fuel prices too high. So, you know, they understand that.
Dan, one of the issues that comes up is if we take a look at the energy sector, even though the price of oil has gone up, the industry has proven they can make money in the shale plays at lower cost. If you take a look at the last 2 or 3 years in the markets, energy has clearly underperformed. And if you look at, for example, in 2018, some of the biggest profits that were in the S&P came from energy companies as the price went up. And if you take a look at what energy companies are making now, why do you think it's been ignored by Wall Street in the investment markets? It seems like they're hung up on technology and other sectors. And energy, even though it's having a good year, when you take a look at the price of oil, it's been an unperformer as an investment class if you look at the stocks.
Yeah, really, all the companies that I followed, 2018 was a pretty decent year. 2017 and 2018 were pretty decent years from a profit standpoint. I just think there's this gloom and doom, dark cloud hanging over the industry. And one thing that doesn't help at all is the fact that, you know, you get oil price going up, it looks like it's going, then it'll pull back, goes up, pulls back. And so many investors do not understand it, and they just throw their hands up and say, you know, every time I get in, it looks like it's going up, and then it pulls back $10 a barrel. So I say all the time, I'd much rather see oil go up 10 cents, you know, 20 cents a week. And instead of these, you know, up $3, down $2, you know, stuff like that, I'd much rather see there be a steady line, but that's never going to happen. So it is a market that the price is established by speculative traders and computer trading. And I think that has a lot of fear hanging over the investors. They don't want to get into it. But I do think it's trading at a deep discount to what the breakup value of these companies are. I do a valuation method that I used when I was at Hess looking at companies for takeover targets. And I can tell you, I've got six or seven companies on my list. These are great large companies that are trading for half of what I think their breakup value is. So there's a lot of good potential out there.
So when we look at energy industry, and I want to talk about, you know, the big factor influencing energy obviously has been the, you know, fracking, horizontal drilling, and shale. If you look at the shale industry now, and especially, you know, the big basins in Texas, Dan, I want to talk about the implications of the majors moving in. You've got Exxon moving in there. You've got Chevron, and they're all talking about doubling their production in that area over the next 3 or 4 years. You've got Occidental. You've got Royal Dutch. And unlike a lot of the smaller companies, these companies have access and plenty of capital and very, very strong and big balance sheets.
Yeah, and they see the potential there now. They believe in it. You know, they all exited the United States a couple decades ago onshore, and they all went offshore. Now they're coming back onshore. And that's why I do think there's going to be some merger activity where these big guys take out some of the smaller companies that have a lot of very good acreage. So that could happen. But the one thing we're up against now in the Permian Basin is takeaway capacity. They're really limited right now that they've filled all the pipelines. And so it's kind of on hold. And that's going to take until about the fourth quarter before there's more pipeline access. They're flaring a whole bunch of gas out there because there's no more room in the gas pipelines. In fact, the spot price for gas actually went very negative last week, actually went to minus $9. You had to pay them to take your gas. So unless only the companies with long-term contracts were able to get any of the decent prices for their gas.
As you look at the energy industry right now, it still, in my opinion, remains undervalued. And the other thing about the energy industry, Dan, they have great cash flow. They're making profits. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the nice thing about some of these companies, you can get dividend yields 4%, 5%, or 6%. So if you're waiting for the stock to go up, at least you're earning something, unlike many of the other stocks that investors are chasing.
Yeah, one of the good things that's come out about this, I think the Wall Street gang has put a lot of pressure on these guys to start returning some capital. You know, they said, hey, look, you know, we've been investing in these shale plays. We hear how great they are, but let's start seeing, free cash flow and start either buying back shares or starting to pay a dividend. And you're starting to see, I even saw Diamondback has declared a small dividend, and that's a relatively new company. Boy, if oil stays in the 60s or 70s, you're going to see these guys generating some significant cash flow because their capital programs for this year are based on $50 oil. I guarantee that. They did it, maybe even $45 oil, because they built these budgets back in November and December, and they're not going to change their drilling programs until they're very confident. But we could see, you know, some uptick in the drilling and second half of this year if oil stays this high. But yeah, there's a lot of good ones now. If you break it down, you say, okay, the upstream companies, these guys that drill and complete wells, that's one group. Then you have the midstream guys. They're the guys that gather it, process it, move it through pipelines, storage. And a lot of those are MLPs, or they used to be MLPs that have converted to C-Corps, and they pay tremendous dividends. If you looked at our newsletter, you see we have a high yield income portfolio, and there's some nice companies on there, 6%, 7%, 8%, 9% dividend yield. And a lot of it, if it's MLPs, it's tax sheltered anyway. So you're not going to find that anywhere. And these are very well capitalized companies. And the one thing I'll tell your listeners is I cannot remember a period this long where the midstream has been this good for this long. And there's years before they're going to reach over capacity again. I mean, they're still in almost all the basins, need more pipelines, need more storage, need more gathering processing, because we've grown production so fast, the midstream guys haven't really kept up with it.
Dan, as you take a look at this sector, I guess the one final question, you know, both you and I are bullish, have been bullish on energy, gosh, for at least the last year or more or so. And I think that's been a right view to hold. But always, I always like to take a look at the other side. What could go wrong? And let's say spoil the idea that energy prices are heading higher. I mean, what could be the thing that neither of us would like to see or could disrupt us.
Well, if there was, if this, let's say this Brexit thing, you know, really causes a big problem in Europe, I don't think that's going to happen. In fact, I think they're going to just keep delaying this and not really do anything for the next year, you know, or they just take, you know, oil prices too high too fast, and that derails the economy, because, you know, high fuel prices are really like an additional tax on consumers and on businesses. So that has to be taken into consideration. So I'm hoping, you know, I think we're at a good enough price. I've said all year that 60 to 65 is what I think is the right price. Now, when you throw in this situation in Libya and how bad Venezuela is getting, I think the right price may be about $70, just based on the geopolitical risk right now. But, you know, I guess if peace came across the world and they started flooding the world with oil again, but I don't see that happening. I think OPEC's got a new sense of discipline, and they lost a lot of money trying to derail the shale plays. Probably several $100 billion have been lost by just Saudi Arabia trying to play that game. So they know that they've got to, you know, be very more controlled in how they do their production up and down.
Final question. If you and I were having this conversation, and it's December 31st this year, unlike last year where we saw the price drop 40% in the fourth quarter, your best guess, if we were talking December 31st, where do you think the price of oil would be?
I think we're going to be 75. We got a real shot at 70. Now, that's WTI. I think Brent could go to 80. And I also think that the differential between West Texas Intermediate, WTI, and Brent is going to shrink. Libya is, what's going on in Libya will probably cause that to shrink, because they produce very light oil and the shale plays produce very light sweet oil. And so that there was a kind of an oversupply of light oil and an undersupply of heavy oil. And now we're going to may balance that out so that we'll get rid of that differential. So I think $70 to $75 oil by the end of the year.
Dan, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow the work that you do at Energy Perspectives, tell them how they can easily do so.
Okay. We are a subscriber-based service, and we publish reports on 30 or 40 companies per quarter. And so 100 something a year. We also have model portfolios. But if your listeners would like to become subscribers, it's normally $350 a year. We'll give them $100 off, or if they say they're a listener to their show. All they need to do is send an email to energyprospectus@gmail.com.
All right, Dan. Well, listen, as always, pleasure having you on the program. And take care, sir. Have a great weekend.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Coming up in Hour 2, The Big Picture. We just dodged a bullet, but for how long? There's a lot of bullishness out there now that the markets have come roaring back this year. Still, there are some new risks that are emerging. Jim Poplav and I will discuss those risks. All of that's coming up in Hour 2, The Big Picture.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.